Hello, Vicky, are you there?
I am here.
Hello. Oh, this is Hardy calling.
Well, hello.
How are you?
I'm all right. And you?
I know there's a time difference, so it's probably several days later there.
Well, it depends if you change your clocks or not.
I'm calling from Kentucky, United States, and you are in... It's so funny because we have a university here that we call UK, University of Kentucky.
I know, and I have been to the University of Kentucky, and there's also the Pacific Lutheran as well, University. But I have been to the UK, and I'm in the UK.
Is the Pacific Lutheran, that is also a country? No, it is not.
No, it's a university.
Okay, it isn't anymore, but that's all right. I'd hate to tell you that.
Is it not?
I don't think so. I think it's gone.
Oh. All right.
So I wanted to call you today because I have some questions for you about UK and not the university.
Okay.
All right. Well, I'm lying. It isn't really about UK. It's about bigger things. I'm using the United Kingdom as a metaphor.
So you're using me?
Essentially, yeah. Isn't that what artists are for?
Yes.
Aren't they like tissues or something? Something we use that is useful to us?
Well, it's even worse than that. We actually reuse.
We reuse tissue. Oh, you know, tissues or handkerchiefs? Which are you for? Would you rather blow your snot into a disposable piece of paper or a nice piece of cloth, which you then fold and deposit in your pocket?
Well, when I used to get hay fever, I used to have hankies.
Uh-huh.
But now I don't get hay fever, I use a tissue.
Right. All right. Well, you're not a keeper, a saver anymore?
Not really.
Mm-hmm.
Not really, no.
Handkerchiefs and cloth diapers are very similar, aren't they? I wouldn't want to be your washing machine if you had either one. Go.
We are as artists, we are reusers. We're not users. And users already has a bad kind of air about it, doesn't it? It's like using drugs or something.
Right, exactly.
If you're a reuser, it's even worse.
User just has a bad connotation in general because you say, you're using people. You're a user.
Yeah.
Right? But then you're online. That's, you're a user. What's your username?
Yeah. Well, you could say that you're a utilizer.
Oh, I like that better.
Yeah.
I like that better, a utilizer.
Utility rooms.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, utility rooms. Does that mean the same thing there as it does here?
Well, I don't know.
I don't either, because I've never used the word, really.
No, nor have I. But also, you have laundry rooms, whereas we tend not to have them unless we're posh.
But I mean, oh.
I go into houses in America, it's like, here's the laundry room.
My laundry room is also a bathroom and also a cat duty room and a storage room. The washer and dryer just shoved into a small closet that also has a commode in it.
Yeah.
So you could sit on the toilet and fold clothes if that was your want.
A commode.
Is that not what you don't, what do you call your, what do you call your toilet?
Toilet.
You call it a toilet. We call it a toilet too. Or a crapper. But no, and people really don't say that.
So.
People tell me, it's called a crapper because someone named Crapper invented it. Which I don't know if I believe that.
But we just call it a toilet. You call it the restroom or the washroom.
I know we have a lot. I addressed that on last week's show, the euphemisms for. The defecation and urination station.
Oh, yeah. I remember that. That's
right.
Why I said it. Yeah. Yeah, it's even better. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know why we're in denial about some bodily functions.
And that character who sounds like Peter Wingard was in there.
Yeah. I tell you what, my accents are a little feeble and I was worried about that. And I thought, no. Don't be, because I like when things are artistically are rendered incorrectly, like shaky looking cartoons or paintings that are all the eyes are too far apart or something. Mm-hmm. And I feel like maybe my vocal caricatures are like that as well, that they're idiosyncratic. Because I think if you do something too well, that's often not good.
Well, we've all got accents. That's the thing. And people forget about that. And so what happens is if I start pronouncing things the way you do, I just sound like an idiot.
Yeah, but, well, I mean, the things that I've talked about before, accents, I mean, whether we want to acknowledge it or not, are voluntary. I mean, we speak because we're imitating. And I've heard people move to other places, and as a way of socializing, you do it unconsciously as you start speaking a little bit like the people that you're surrounded by. Because that's what accents are. It's a way of identifying who's in your community, right? And so we do adjust our speech. I think I have friends who are North Americans that moved to the UK, for example, and they don't start, they don't start speaking like this or anything, right? But they do, something happens a little bit to their voice, right? Little slight pronunciation differences. They lose their American regional accent a bit.
And turn into Peter Wingard. Yes, exactly.
But So I wanted to, this is a little bit relevant to the UK. So I'm going to read you something that I like, and then I want to tell you about somebody who I'm interested in and get your thoughts on it.
Okay.
So here's the quote. This quote is from Wordsworth. Do you have Wordsworth there? Do you have him there? Do you have Wordsworth?
Just read it.
I'm a Coleridge man, really. I think Wordsworth was piggybacking on the wonderful, talk about a user. Mm-hmm. Coleridge had a little substance problem. So here's a quote. Giants, ventriloquists, the invisible girl, the bust that speaks and moves its goggling eyes, the waxwork, clockwork, all the marvelous craft of modern Merlins, wild beasts, puppet shows, all out of the way, far-fetched, perverted things, all freaks of nature, all Promethean thoughts of man, his dullness, madness, and their feats, all jumbled up together to compose a parliament of monsters. So this parliament of monsters he's talking about is the Bartholomew Fair, mm-hmm. about early 19th century, mm-hmm. 1800s. And the reason I was reading it is because it was in a book about the Great Belzoni. Have you ever heard of the Great Belzoni?
Well, if I'd done my revision, I'd say yes.
Oh, because I told you earlier that I was going to. So
no.
Giovanni, no, you have heard it. So you
no,
haven't.
I haven't.
Okay, so let me just briefly tell you, most people have not.
Good.
And which is why I bring him up. Giovanni Belzoni was born in like the 1780s in Italy. And he studied as a young man hydraulics and things like that. He was interested in sort of like engineering. And he eventually, politics found him in 1803 moving to England, mm-hmm. where he got work because he was 6'7", which at the time is very big, is big, strong man, 6'7". And he got work at these fairs and circuses, right, doing a strongman act.
Mm-hmm.
And being in pantomimes as like the giant in Jack the Beanstalk and stuff.
Yeah.
So he became like a performer. People say circus performer, but it was really these fairs. And he would also use his engineering skills to do sort of basic stage magic, like have naval battles, you know, with little models and water tanks and things like that.
Uh-huh.
And a really interesting guy. And he finally realized his engineering ambition by moving to, he was commissioned by Muhammad Ali, not the boxer, to go to Egypt and do a, make a device to move water from the Nile to this guy's crops. One thing led to another, and the next thing he knew, he was searching for and excavating Egyptian antiquities.
I hate it when that happens.
Don't you? But he wanted to do this. So he was hired by the British consul to go out and find these antiquities. And he had a real knack, like almost a supernatural knack for finding the tombs.
Yeah.
All right. And then this brilliant engineering skills where he could excavate, you know, these artifacts, some of which weighed tons, right? So the best known thing is the head of Seti, Rameses or something in they're called the Young Memnon in the British Museum.
Yeah.
The big stone head, right?
Yeah.
And he excavated that, weighs 7 tons.
Yeah.
And he got it out of the sand and to England. I don't know if he ever knew that it was put on display, because he died of yellow fever or something when he was 40. But
yeah.
He had this amazing career, and nobody knows who he was, basically, because his name never was put on anything, because the guy who hired him, Henry Salt, put his name on everything.
Yeah, he hired him as a worker.
Yeah, exactly. And yet he's the one who found everything, did all the work, got it all done,
yep.
and was the creative and the brilliant mind behind it. So you can see where I'm going with this sort of.
Yeah.
All right, that we were talking about using people, using Kleenex, and
yeah.
he was used in this wonderful way, both for his height, you know, when he was just a tall person, he was used for his intellect and his engineering ability, and he is relatively unknown, and yet he's one of the most colorful characters, I think, to ever live at that time.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of, yeah, I mean, it's sad when that happens, because it's normal that, you know, we have this kind of hierarchy of people that use more people, and then the people that you hear about are the ones at the very top of the triangle.
Right, and an entertainment business works like this, doesn't it? I mean, you know, the people that take the credit for things are the, you know... And you'll hear that all the time from producers. Now, my genius is assembling a crew of brilliant people. And they really see it that way. My genius is hiring writers.
Well, it's a bit like when you become a director or something. I mean, what people often do, you know, they start off doing stuff themselves. And then when they get more successful, they get other people to do that thing that they were first doing, whether that be, you know, like, you know, David Lynch getting more crew, or, you know, if you're a footballer, you eventually manage the football team, or, you know, you get other people, you kind of, you buy yourself out of the thing that is your idea, and you stand around and become, you're the conductor rather than the orchestra.
I'm sure that Jeff Koons and let's say, David or somebody else who did those large paintings that one person can't do by themselves.
Yeah.
You know, the artists have always used crews.
Yeah.
On large things, you know, and merely directed it or had the overall idea, and then other people actually go and execute it. And, you know, for you and I, who work at this level of being both the boss and the crew, right?
Yeah.
You know, this self-contained. I always feel like we're more like guys on the street corner doing a puppet show.
Or the one-man band.
Yeah, the one-man band, exactly. I've always had an affinity for that. I've always wanted to be, you know, that person who's who's made the puppet, who's made the stage, then has to go out and perform it and all that. I like that. You don't ever work at the grand scale, I mean, because those definitely are group efforts, but there's something to me wonderful about it, and yet you don't remember the name of the person who had that great puppet show on the street corner. And yet I think that's where the magic sometimes really is. Maybe I'm romanticizing it, because, you know, that's my perspective.
Well, I mean, of course, I think everyone romanticizes the idea that one person, did you do all that kind of thing? And, you know, it's certainly commendable, if not insane, when people do everything all by themselves and they've just made something massive, and it's kind of, you know, it's sent them half crazy and they're tired out of their mind and that kind of thing. And I kind of, you know, I can also see how, if you get the chance to get a crew, wouldn't that be nice as well? But what I find weird is the people making the work, it's the process of making a piece of work. Half of your ideas come about through the making of the work. So you get a crew to make the work. Are they getting ideas or not? And Are you getting ideas from them doing that work? Because how do you know if you're just doing stuff on your own? How do you progress other than becoming the person who directs? You know, how do you get the inside information carrying on where you actually are the center part of that thing?
So I'm glad you said crazy and insane in there, because when we were talking about this, it made me think about certain individuals who do these undertakings, are usually artistic, usually what we call art brute, right? Or so what's the English word for that? Art brute. What do we call that? Not primitive art or something?
Yeah.
But I'm thinking of the people that...
Right,
I know exactly what I'm trying to... There's another name for it there.
Courgettes, you know.
Yeah, right, courgettes, zucchini, same thing.
It's all over.
So I was thinking of people that do things like... The first thing that comes to mind is that individual who has glued bottle caps to his car over the years or something, or has made a castle out of old bottles or something.
Yeah, follies.
Right,
follies?
And there's in the art museum in Washington, I guess it's one of the Smithsonian's or something. There's something made out of, I don't know whether it's tin foil or something. It's like a palace room, you know. They've got an art brute section there, and it's my favorite section actually, next to the portrait gallery. And it's, you know, all this thing made out of, I guess, scrap metal, and I'm remembering it wrong, maybe. In my mind, it's all aluminum foil, but I think that's probably not true. But, you know, but it's this undertaking. But one person, their vision completely realized from their head, with no intermediary, right? There's nobody else doing the work. And like you say, it evolves as you're doing it, because if you've ever done anything like that, it's a meditative thing, right? You're working on something, and you're changing as you're doing it, so your ideas are changing as you're doing it. Whereas if I was just to have a script that I wrote 10 years ago, hand it to somebody, they make it, it doesn't really... That's different, right? Because then they add to it, and it's not one person just the vision vomiting out of their brain into reality, which I think is such a beautiful thing, right? And it often looks messy and crazy, and we always characterize it, or usually characterize it, as insanity, right? Because it's sort of it hasn't been shaped by the expectations of others, right? You think your thoughts are normal. And then other people go, no, we can't have that, and that's weird, or we've got to trim these edges, or don't you want that corner sanded? And it becomes something else. And as we do things collectively, we tend to take edges off or put things on that we think need to be there. But the vision of individuals is always strange, and it baffles me that we see it as strange, because we should immediately recognize it as what's going on in our heads. Don't you think? And yet we say, no, it's the collective vision seems more right in a way.
Well, attested.
Yeah, I guess because we do it that way.
Well, we try things out, and eventually we get used to it, and then it's okay. But when you're experimenting and you're doing stuff on your own, you're going to be the person that's going to get shot for sticking your neck out. And then the people directing it, you know, they're the ones who, you know, if something goes right for you, they can get the safe praise for it. But I was just thinking, actually, what would happen if you asked someone else to meditate for you?
That is not what when you say, please pray for me.
Yeah,
now that's
yeah.
what you do when you tell people, go, please pray for me. Please, could you meditate for me?
Well, if you're a Buddhist, you go, would you meditate for me, please?
Yes, I think that makes sense, doesn't it? I'd like to hire people to do all the things. Could you diet for me? Could you eat right correctly for me?
Well, it's like when you join the gym and you don't go.
I want to ask you, Vicky, I know you're a vegetarian. Could you be, and I wish I was, but I sometimes I backslide. Could you be a vegetarian for me?
Sure.
Then I could have the occasional piece of fish and everything.
Yeah, sure.
All right, thank you.
How Ooh. Much will you pay me?
Isn't there something in religion like that where you did hire people
yeah,
to do...
Yeah, of course you do. All the time in religion, you get other people to kill stuff for you.
Right, to fulfill some sort of obligation.
Yeah, so it's all about ritual, isn't it, actually?
Mm-hmm. People used to, didn't they pay for other people to take their place in war and stuff? If you could pay for somebody, you could get out of the draft. I know they did here, I think, during the Civil War. I think you could pay somebody to go fight for you if you had enough money.
Sure. But, yeah, to die for you. Is that
Yeah, like, could you go die? Can I ask you a huge favor? I need you to go fight and die for me because I just bought a gold commode. And I'd like to sit upon it. And if I'm dead, I can't.
I know you like the queen. You know the Beefeaters?
Mm-hmm.
Well, they ate I'm sure they ate the food for royalty, didn't they, to see if it was poisoned?
Oh, was that? Yeah, all right. I wonder how they became associated with gin. But that's another story. Yes, I think they did, right. I wonder if that's... And that it seems like that would still be pertinent some places, like dictators.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that like some people have food tasters still.
Yeah. Well, isn't that a cook?
Isn't it cook? The cook out, but the cook could be the problem. Right? You don't know what he's putting in the food.
Yeah.
Maybe tried to poison us. Oh, bless the... Oh, you know, I'm not a... I have mixed feelings about... This is the way in my life in general, is I have philosophical opinion or, you know, general opinions about things, right? Political stances. Like, I am against monarchs. I'm anti-monarch, right? But I think if I met any of them as individuals, see, I think I would be fine with them. I would like them personally.
I know you follow the Queen on Twitter.
I do. I think that Harry is a nice fella. I almost said bloke. That Harry is a nice bloke.
Is he a lovely man?
I don't know if he is or not, right? I know he dressed in a Nazi uniform for a costume party one time, but I think he's grown up since
he's
then.
He's had a terrible time.
Well, I know he lost his mom and everything. That's no fun.
No,
right?
It's not.
I don't know. William, I'm not so sure about. He seems smug to me. Mm-hmm. Am I misreading him? But Harry, I feel like, aren't you a royal father? Don't you get magazines with their pictures and cut them out and make little posters of them and things like that? And aren't you concerned with their...
I used to.
You know, I'm fascinated with people that are low-level royals or not quite, you know, or whatever, and sponge off of other people.
Yeah.
Like, have no real resources and go around being like the token prince or baron or something and get other people to pay their bills.
Yeah.
Just because people are impressed with that. That always tickles me.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I did that on the show, as you know. The Baron of Baltimore.
Yes.
Not an actual baron, perhaps. And, but I like that because it's like you can, you know, other people's expectations always interest me.
Well, he sounds a lot like the Peter Wingard character.
Well, I'll tell you. Let me tell you about Hans Conried. Hans Conried, who is the feeble impression I'm doing.
Yeah.
Was from Baltimore, actually from Baltimore.
Okay.
So he's speaking in this manner, as does Edward Everett Horton, who is from Brooklyn. Edward Everett Horton was from Brooklyn, and yet he spoke like this, right? Because that was how actors were taught to speak at a certain time, right? The transatlantic accent. And it fascinates me because, you know, that's not how they speak. And Baltimore and Brooklyn have a very distinctive American English accent, right? Two of the most distinctive ones, probably. And yet those two fellas speak in the strangest manner, you know.
George Martin,
not personally.
He's not posh.
Oh no, isn't he?
No,
it's put on.
Yeah.
Oh, that's funny. Where's he really from?
He's just got a London accent.
Oh, that's hilarious. I remember I was with you out in California, and there was another Britisher. Is that what you call them? Is that what you call each other? And he said, where are you from? He heard you speak. And he said, where are you from? Mm-hmm. And you said, London. And he was like, you know, originally. And you were like, no. So where are you? You're originally from, not London, but where's your family from?
East Anglia.
East Anglia. And that is where, for our non-UK knowledgeable listeners, where would that be?
London.
So you're from London?
No,
you're not.
Just, you oh, come on. It's like...
No, not everybody knows. Look.
It's the bit that sticks out above the... It's the bit that sticks out above London is East Anglia.
Right.
So it's the country. But right. It's about 60 miles from London. And you see, we're a little island, so everything isn't very far. And in America, like, you know, people will travel hundreds of miles to come and say hi. And whereas here, people won't even, you know, get a bus across London to come and see you.
Look, I'm from a small town where literally people won't walk two blocks to see your show.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, you know, I'm in for the night. And even though you're playing, you know, walking distance, so that there's a lot of places that are a lot like that. But what fascinates me is how many different accents there are in on that island,
yeah,
given how small it is.
Yeah, well, Jack Hargreaves explained that, you know, who we all know who Jack Hargreaves is.
Yes, if only we all knew who he was. I do, because you turned me on to old Jack.
Yeah, well, basically, if you get a map of Britain and then you get a compass and then you make it the width of 15 miles and then you put it around the town, that will be where the next town is, because it's where people would take their 15-mile radius was the most that you could take a horse to market.
Wow, yeah, it's all back to the horses with Jack.
Yeah.
With his pony.
Yeah.
He loves that pony. He loved that pony. He's so gone now. He's gone. They don't make him like Jack anymore.
But we were talking about that thing of where you're a worker and you are taking risks or doing work for other people and then they get the credit, which is, you know, everyone calls that work, don't they?
But yes.
You know, that's what people do, isn't it? Mm-hmm. But when it's artistry, when it's creating things, it is different, and it's not different because, you know, it's nothing special being an artist, and, you know, people romanticize that. It's you shouldn't romanticize it. It's just is something that everyone does, but some poor souls decide that they're going to do it more often. But what I think is interesting is when people are making art, and someone else, for whatever reason, then goes on to put you on on their platform.
Mm-hmm.
They then, you know, like maybe a radio producer or something like that. They would then, you would be theirs. So that idea that, well, at what point is it that it's yours, and at what point does it become someone else's? Your content is, you know. So similarly, if you've done a bit of a painting, is the most you're ever going to do is take your friends along and go, I did that bit.
Yeah, and you know, things change. Like, once it's out of your hands and everything, I'm not even sure you can claim it so much. So you sent me a copy of Roadside Picnic, which is the book on which the Tarkovsky movie Stalker is based.
I did, because I thought I'd rather you read it than I did.
So I read it, and let me tell you, it's different. It's totally, the movie, I would say, even has a different theme.
Right.
You know, and emphasizes something completely different than what the book does.
Okay.
And it's amazing to me. There's a similarity in the terms and everything like that, but the story is completely, utterly different. It's just different story altogether. So if the people that wrote Roadside Picnic were to say, oh, that movie is, you know, they made our book into a movie. It's not true.
Yeah.
They didn't really. And I know that Tarkovsky has said that, you know, he picks books that he feels are somehow incomplete, which he did with Ivan's Childhood, right? You know, I don't like the way this book, I don't like what the focus of the book was, or I think that it was emotionally insufficient, you know, so I'm taking it and using it just as simply as a template. Or, you know, I'm going to use the terminology, I'll use the character names, but I'm going to do something totally different with it.
Well, that's like Yodorovsky making Dune, which he didn't, but he did.
Right, right, right.
Because he never read the book.
That's beautiful, though. Isn't that excellent? I remember Larry King, I think, maybe I'm misrepresenting this, the old radio interviewer would say, you know, that I don't want to read the book before I interview the person because I want to have some good questions, you know, like, what's the book about?
Yeah.
And like that, you know, but in a way, it's sort of interesting to make things like that. I've gotten ideas for shows based on things that I haven't fully finished the book, or I've done that completely.
Yeah, totally.
Where you use something to jumpstart your own idea.
Well,
but you're
also,
not...
if you know too much about something, then you've already fixed it in your head and then it's over, isn't it? Because, you know, it's a bit like once something is finished, then it's a lot more difficult to reopen it. Whereas if you're only 20 pages in whatever way that might mean, then you can carry on and make it into whatever you want without anyone else knowing what anyone else did with it.
And that happens to me with books all the time, especially. But I'll read a few pages and I'll think, this gives me a great idea. You know, I almost won't want to finish the book because I want to go do my own thing.
I'll read about 15 paragraphs or so, 15 pages or something, and then I'll write all these notes down, and then I'll read another book.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I was, you know, I would, obviously we were all watching a lot of. David Lynch, and I would watch something, and you know the thing I would take away from it is like, ooh, I should use more static,
yeah,
or something. You know, nothing, you know, nothing thematic, you know, not just being inspired by one small thing. Like it's like looking at a painting and going, oh, I got to use that shade of green.
I'm the same. It's like I've just got more fuzz in my work now.
Yeah, yeah, and I like that. That's how sometimes how things evolve. You know, it isn't the entire, and that's a good metaphor for evolution and genetics and everything. It isn't. You don't take the whole thing and add on to it.
Yeah.
You know, it's little parts that get used.
Yeah.
And that becomes useful. You know, the whole thing perhaps isn't useful, but if you can get a little something out of it. You know, like when you buy those people bid on storage units with hopes that, you know, one thing in one trunk is going to be worth something and everything else could just be possibly discarded.
Yeah.
Art is like that, too. It's like you buy a big storage unit and maybe you hope that there's one good thing in it.
Uh-huh.
I don't know. Like this show.
Yeah.
And I try to lower people's expectations like that for art too with the show. I say, okay, you know, you're getting an hour. And now, you know, cull through it. Mm-hmm. You're not going to get an hour of pure bliss, you know? You really are going to get some rocks with your gems and you've got to, you know, kind of brush the dirt away because there might be something in there. And to train yourself to look for the, you know, the little sparkle of gold as you're panning endless hours through, you know, just looking through mud and detritus and everything. And that's how you find the little shiny things.
Well,
you know,
actually, when I listen to your shows, I get the same thing as when I'm reading a book and I say, oh, don't say anything else. I've just had an idea.
Right. I know. I've seen that. Or people will quote my show and I go, that wasn't intended to be a quote. You know, I go with that. That's not the profound thing. I said that next, and it's beautiful. I secretly love it. All my love is secret.
Oh, by the way, Roadside Picnic. Is it anything like Wizard of Oz by any chance?
Not at all. That's the thing. See,
right, okay.
And I don't want to spoil anything for you because you might. But
I'm not going to read it.
You're not going to read it. But like Monkey, all right, his daughter Monkey, looks like an actual monkey. Like she's furry and she has no whites of her eyes. She's got black eyes and she's got fur all over her and everything. And she's an actual monkey.
She is a monkey.
Also, there's this the zone has caused corpses to rise up and be animated. So Red the Stalker, his dead father sort of hangs out at their house. He's just a zombie. And he sits there and he can drink vodka and everything, but he's just like, it's not, and also it's not even set in Russia. I know it's a Soviet era novel, but the actual thing isn't even in Russia. It's very, very interesting.
Isn't the book interesting?
it's weird because I got something totally different than Tarkovsky got out of it. It's beautiful. I think that's a beautiful thing. I mean, that's the way art is. You cannot control what people are going to see. You know, you can sort of connect with people.
Because I just looked at a PDF of it once of Roadside Picnic just to try and get the general idea about it, so I didn't have to read the book, which I'm still kind of there. But there's a quote in it that says, "Happiness is for everybody. Free as much as you want. Everybody come here. There's enough for everybody. Nobody will leave unsatisfied. Free, happiness, free." And it was that actually gave me the idea of what that was about in relation to Stalker, but also The Wizard of Oz, which made me make a piece of art. But so it was based upon something that... So I never read the book. So here's an exact reason why, to summarise what the hell I'm talking about before I forget, was that I often only read... It's like reading the back of the book.
Yes.
Yeah, so who is this? Who is this person?
There's nothing wrong with that, because you can't distill something until you've made it. I mean, you can't have a blurb on the back of the book.
Where are you going?
Until there's a book. I was looking for. Hang on. I put a misplaced a book
Come
that I
back.
Wanted to. It was my Burgess book. The guy who came up with the word blurb, but that's okay.
No. Basically, hard luck if you're trying to remember anything.
Oh, my memory has gotten really—it's shot.
If I could just sit here and really quickly look up Wikipedia every time you say something, because most of the things that you're reading to me, I have no idea who they are, and I'd really like to pretend that I'm more intelligent than I am, you see.
Oh, I do too. I would love to. And the minute I open my mouth, I say something stupid. A friend was interviewing me on his podcast, and he's probably listening right now, and he's awesome. And I guess I was trying to be, no, he really is. So I was trying to be a peer. To be intellectual.
Oh yeah.
Right, and so I said the name of a art critic, and I pronounced it wrong.
Exactly, it's like.
That's the theme of my life.
Yeah, totally.
And I read a quote something about Michael Jackson, doing that one time. Michael Jackson was talking to somebody, and he said something as, "Oh, isn't that from, Plato or something." You know, he had read about Plato, but he'd never heard it pronounced out loud, right? No, and that's my problem too. I'll have read something. I've never gotten in a conversation or taken a class or anything about it. So I'll just, in my enthusiasm, I'll say it and people go, "No, that isn't." And you look ignorant, but in fact, people who are curious, that's often what happens, because they'll read something, they'll remember it for a reason, and they don't necessarily know how to pronounce it correctly, but it doesn't mean that they're ignorant. It just means that they, they don't have an in-depth knowledge, perhaps, but they have a curiosity, which I think sometimes is almost more important.
Well, I have a very good example I am actually reading a book at the moment and I don't know how to pronounce it. And I'm not even going to say it because I'm embarrassed that I don't know how to pronounce it. Whereas I already asked you in a text, "Have you read?" And you went, "Some of it." And maybe you can't pronounce it either, but I'm going to type it into Facebook. Okay.
Oh, was it the Upanishads?
Yeah, see? Is that how you pronounce it?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure.
Right, okay.
I hope so, boy.
Is that the American way of pronouncing it?
I don't know. You know, that's the other thing is that we can always, I always tell people, oh, that's the anglicized pronunciation.
Because you know what? I'm sure you just said it the British way.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I'm sure it's like ah.
Upon Ashad?
No, I.
Upanishads?
You just, yeah, that sounds like how you'd say it. Whereas when you first said it, you said it like you were Peter Wingard.
Upanishads.
Yeah, there you go. Upanishads.
Well, you know, first of all, in my opinion, vowels are up for grabs. Like, you know, vowels are just...
That's why there's only five left.
They evolve more quickly. That's why accents... Basically, regional accents involve variation in vowel pronunciation because they change more quickly than other parts of speech, other you know, consonants do. Could we, I guess, pretty much pronounce consonants the way we always do. Some things are harder and softer, right?
Are you just making G's this up?
No. So again, this is one of those. There was a mini series on about the English language about 20 years ago.
Oh, right, you saw it on the telly.
Yeah, and that's how I get most of my information. And I've always been fascinated with accents.
Yeah.
And they did say this mainly because, you know, I'm a couple accents in my life are people that I've known have had regional accents that don't exist anymore.
Yeah.
And ways of speaking English that don't exist anymore. So it's fascinating to me. And I know that the UK is probably going through that. I know that there's accents that are essentially disappearing because we are more connected now than our 15-mile horse trading route, right? So,
yeah.
Or route. So I know that, that's the case. And we're gonna speak more alike, right? I think in the future.
I went to my meditation class last night, and there was a new chap who was leading the meditation. And as soon as he started speaking, he had the most strongest old London accent. I just could not stop just staring at him talking.
Like and a Cockney kind of
yes,
accent?
Or, yeah,
oh, like, my God, that is totally disappearing, right?
Yeah, and it was so strong.
What do you call the new one? Estuary or something, do people say?
I don't know.
I don't know what it's called.
But yeah, I mean, it's very, but it was like so strong, you know, like, in Oliver, the film Oliver Twist.
Right.
Like that. Right. So it was like that. And, you know, who's leading this meditation is obviously very good at teaching this thing, you know, completely eloquently, but with this really strong accent. And, you know, you're meant to have your eyes closed. And I was just staring at him.
Oh, man, that's fun. It's like, who was that? Who was the actor who played the Artful Dodger in the...
Oh, should I look him up?
Yeah, because he was on... he was on H.R. Puff and Stuff, which is a great campy TV show.
Right.
I'm blanking on his name because...
Oh, right, Jack Dawkins.
No.
He's a cheeky chappy with a good hat.
What's his...
In Oliver, in the film Oliver.
Yeah, yeah. What's the actor's name?
The Artful Dodger is Jack Hawkins.
Oh, who am I thinking of then?
I only know him and Oliver.
Really. Oh, okay. I don't want to. So what's the?
There's also Jack Wilde.
Jack Wilde. Jack Wilde. Jack Wilde. That's who I'm thinking of. Jack Wilde. I didn't know there was two different actors named Jack who played it.
Yeah.
Oh, that's confusing, isn't it?
Yeah.
I remember one time when I was a child, there was a Western called Alias Smith and Jones.
Yeah, yeah.
And
yeah.
One of them, Smith or Jones, in real life, committed suicide.
Did he?
So they had a new Smith or Jones or whatever, and I was like, well, that isn't him.
That's weird. So always, when they do that.
Yeah. I was like, what? And I guess you're supposed to just, you know, suspend your disbelief, which I'm doing anyway.
Yeah.
And then you got to do it on another level.
But I think it's a bit much doing it twice. It's like Inception.
Right. Exactly. Oh, you just saw Inception, didn't you?
I did. Yeah. I'm. I oh, was, it's the... I've got this general rule. I tend to try and get into things 5 to 10 years later than everyone else.
Good, because then we're not tired of, we're tired of people talking about them back then, but you wait until it's been a while. That's admirable. Thank you doing that.
I go one step beyond that. I try and make it my business to not actually even know that it happened in the first place.
And about if I'm still on the air in 5 years, I'm going to talk about nothing but Twin Peaks: The Return. I'm waiting until nobody will remember any details about it. Then I can make things up.
Although it's quite likely that people will be talking about it quite a lot in 5 years' time.
Well, you know, if they try to make it, if they try to make another season, even more actors are going to be dead.
Yeah.
Don't you think? I mean, there was some people like in this one that were pretty old. I mean, I don't want anything to happen to them, but let's face it, some of them were, you know, close to 80, and there were already people that were in it that are dead.
And dying were people that all the way through it as well.
Right, exactly. There were two people in that actively dying.
Yeah, the log lady, didn't she die during it?
Log lady died, and then Miguel Ferrer died right after. So yeah. He was already sick when he was in it, right?
And then Harry Dean Stanton died just after.
And died just after, and Doc Hayward had a little cameo there, Skype cameo, and he died.
But don't you think it's weird because it's like, well, in the UK, no one's even seen the Twin Peaks Series 3 yet because it's not been on here. So that's weird, right? So that's Inception Level 1, right? Inception Level 2 is Twin Peaks. They finished filming it, what, about 2 years ago?
Mm-hmm.
So David Lynch has been going around doing his shopping, whatever it is that he does in the daytime, sitting looking out the window having a cigarette. And he's like, well, I've finished Twin Peaks. I finished Twin Peaks. And they're saying that for 2 years.
Yeah. It always fascinates me. Yeah. But same with actors, you know. It's just like that movie I'm in is coming out, and you think, oh, you were just in it? And you go, I don't even remember it.
Yeah.
You know, or I don't even have those muscles anymore if it's a superhero movie or something.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, I was all pumped up for that one. Now I'm back to being fat.
So time is a weird thing because we know when you're an artist, like when you finish something, it's done. It's just like, forget it.
Right.
Something else now. Which I think is a very good reason to not finish anything, by the way.
Well, we work, and I've been doing this weekly show for 5 years.
Yeah.
So I come up with an idea. I work hard either thinking or doing literal, you know, recording and everything. And I get it all ready, and I do the show, and it goes out there. You know, I've done it all beginning to end. I put it out there. It broadcasts, and then that's it. It's done, and never talk about it again.
And then you got to start again.
And then I got the next day, I wake up, and there is no, like, debut. I don't get to go to a party at the end, and everybody will go, oh, that was a fantastic one.
Yes, darling, moi, that was lovely.
People say, I remember that one thing you said, maybe, but I don't know, you know, because I have to forget about them because it's kind of painful in a way. Because if I was like waiting for something to happen, you know, because there's weeks where people say, "Oh, that's wonderful show," or you get an email or something, and then there's times where you go literally weeks and think, you know, are people listening to it? And it's a weird thing. I like it because I've always felt a need to self-torture. So I think it's a wonderful way of sort of abusing your psyche.
Well, particularly the more you put into something and the deeper you go, the less people on the surface are even going to know you're in that hole.
Yes. Yeah, they don't know you're in
the
hole.
I like that silence is considerably longer than it was, wasn't it? Just then.
What?
When you
I was thinking, well, sometimes you say things, I find myself responding. If I respond quickly, I probably haven't really heard what you said. Because, I mean, occasionally you'll say something, and if I'm silenced because I'm thinking, let me think about that for just a second before we respond so quickly, right?
I know, we should slow down.
I don't know, but we can't because it's radio, and if we do, they don't want to hear us go,
But in my dinner with Andre, how fast do they speak in that? Do they go quiet, don't they, because they're eating something?
Yeah, but both of them are kind of fast talkers who speak in that really bizarre, unnatural, articulate manner that most people don't talk like that.
And
most people's thoughts aren't that cogent.
So when you immerse in something, so if you really, really think you're doing something justice and it takes you a really long time and, you know, you really, you know, you are like digging a hole, basically, to go and see what's inside something. Basically, you're leaving. The further you deep down and the more smaller you make that hole to really, really focused on your little aperture, which needs to be really small to be able to see what something is, the more people you leave behind. How does that feel?
I'm thinking about it. So you're saying, I'm going to psychologist you. So
psychologist me.
So what you're saying, that's how we say it here. I don't know how y'all pronounce it. What do you say? You guys say alienist. So what we do is, what are you saying is that the more you focus, the more people you cut out?
Yep.
Well, that's very true. I mean, and I feel like that, but you do and you don't. Like, I find references are like that. So I make a lot of references to either philosophy or movies or things like that. And I don't feel the need to say what I'm referencing, right? I just, because I'm a thief. I don't really want you to know where I got it. I want you to think maybe it was an original idea. But I realize that some people are going to have a totally different, like the other week, I kind of referenced Stalker. More actually, Roadside Picnic, because there was something in it that really, a couple lines that really resonated with me. So I integrated it. And then somebody on the comments was like, "Oh, Stalker." And I was like, "Oh, wow, good, you know, good catch." Nobody caught the Buñuel reference. Referenced Exterminating Angel, which I'd like to do more of because that's such a great movie. But I guess it's been done. People have stolen that to death, though. That's another thing. Something's been, you know. It's like it is like an Egyptian tomb. You know, sometimes things have been the tomb has been already raided, and everybody's gotten all the good stuff out of it too, right? And that's the thing. When Belzoni would find some of these untouched graves, right? And he would like tombs that people didn't know were there.
Yeah.
And so he'd get all this. It was nothing but fresh stuff. But if you already a lot of them you'd find the tomb, you think you're the first one, and you go in there and you realize that for the last 1,000 years, thieves have been breaking in and taking things.
Or you go in there and it's a portal to another dimension. I like those ones.
Does that happen? I wonder if that happens.
It's really rare. I mean, you're more likely to win the lottery, but every now and then you'll go into one of those tombs. And you can go, it will join sometimes to the other tombs somewhere else.
Now, I was told that the curse of Tutankhamun was actually poisoned cheese spores or something. So they opened up the tomb, they walk in there, and they get a puss full of bad air. Because it's been, you're walking into something where stuff's been rotting without any air circulation for a couple thousand years, right? So you're going to get, you know, the first people in are going to get so-called cursed. It's like going into the zone.
Yeah.
And I wonder if you can get sort of transported to another time mentally, like without knowing it, by immersing yourself in something that's from that time, and all of a sudden you've been propagandized by the past. And you haven't really realized it.
Well, you do all the time, don't you?
Me, you, one? Are you saying one or me, Hardy White?
I wasn't particularly picking on you, no.
Okay, because you said you. I wasn't sure because I thought you all said one.
One. Okay, I'll one, be the queen. I'll one be the does, queen.
I thought one you said that. We. One does that. One is very useful, though. In German, don't they say man when they mean one?
Like, by the way, The French have 6 vowels, not 5.
What other vowel do they have?
Why?
Well, because I'm curious. Thank you. We're a vaudeville comedy team.
Yeah, hilarious.
Oh, that was beautiful. That's it. Oh. But y'all, it's so funny. I would just like to say something about so-called English humor, which is thought in this country to be highbrow. When in fact, I would say that most of English humor that I'm familiar with is just about as lowbrow as you could possibly get.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Am I wrong?
No.
But good Lord, you know, I would like to, because I had the good fortune of being exposed to some British comedy as a young man, and particularly the goodies. And for some reason, a lot of people, you know, my age and all, were, you know, a lot of them, of course, saw Monty Python because it played on public TV here widely, right? So everybody. Too many people are Monty Python fans, and I realized that when I worked in a cheese shop.
Right.
And it just got, it was like, oh, stop, you have to stop. Don't quote Monty Python to me. I have to work in this cheese shop. It just, you're killing me, you know? If you say Wensleydale or something to me, I'm gonna slap you.
Yeah.
But my local PBS station played the goodies.
Yeah.
You know, Tim Brooke Taylor
and
Bill Oddie and Bill Oddie. Is it Oddie? It's Oddie, right?
With his Union Jack wife.
Oh man, that changed my life. I thought this is great.
Yeah.
Why are none of my friends watching this? You know, I didn't even get all this stuff. You know, I don't. It still was hilarious, even if you don't get the cultural references, right?
Yeah,
you know,
totally.
But that whole icky thump thing was like hilarious
icky
to me.
Thump.
Icky thump. And yeah, that's great. You don't even have to know what it, I mean, later I learned, right? But
it's
at
a
the
northern
time. Right, exactly. I figured that out years later. But at the time, you know, it was still so awesome to me.
Yeah.
Just not even knowing it because it was just so wacky. And I don't know why I brought up I guess we were talking about lowbrow humor.
Oh yeah, no, we were talking about the British accent that you can't win, basically. People either think you're funny, an idiot, or you're a snob.
Right, even when you have like what is a lower class, I hate to say class, but you know what I mean, not posh, working class accent, people still think you're somehow... or they can't distinguish them, which is funny too, you know, on TV shows.
When we came back from meditation last night, I confessed about that my dismay at not being able to get rid of this person's accent to be able to meditate. I did actually meditate, but when we're driving back, we suddenly went, oh, hang on, people must think that about us as well.
Right. Is he saying ohm or home?
Yeah, right.
Ohm! Ohm!
I know.
That's so neat, though. I like that. But I wish I could do accents better so I could do my impression of the Cockney Buddhist. That sounds like a good pub name. The Cockney Buddhist sounds like a good pub name.
Yeah, I'm so scared that I can't become more friendly with him now, can I?
But he's not going to listen to my show.
No, but if you, eventually, if you become friendly with someone, they find out everything you've said about them.
No, not true.
No, okay.
Especially, I'll tell you what, you know who never listens to your work? Family. Have you noticed that? It's like, oh, have you ever? No. Have you ever listened to my show? Oh, no. People have family.
Well, my mum does.
Oh, yeah. Well, my mother does, too. My mother excluded. Extended family, though, they don't care.
Yeah.
Don't you do radio or something?
Well, yeah.
How's that going?
Well, that's the thing. It's like, you know, you say you're an artist or something, and they go, and you tell them what you're doing. They go, oh, that's nice. And then you say, oh, I've been so busy. And they go, oh, great. You know, like that means you've got loads of money. Because you're working all the time. Therefore, you must be making loads of money. But it's like, no, I'm just working all the time.
Oh, hang on. That's the end of the show. Thank you, Vicky. Bye. Don't hang up. You are listening to Miracle Nutrition on WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, 91.9 in New York City and Rockland County, and online worldwide at WFMU.org. Thank you so much for listening, and I will see you again next week.